Well, I mentioned in my introduction to the theme of today's service that my approach regarding the abortion debate will not be so much one of advocating for a position as much as an attempt to understand the issue and to explore if there's some common ground between the two poles. Since the leaked draft from the Supreme Court in relation to their expected upcoming ruling on abortion rights, there have been numerous articles and opinion pieces, and I thought I would read one of them that looks for common ground in the midst of the highly polarized positions and opinions. And this is an opinion piece written by the Washington Post columnist Christine Emba. It was published about a month ago on May 13, and it's titled, "Abortion Feels Hyperpolarized, But What If It's Not?" So it's a fairly lengthy article, and so to help you follow along, we're putting the words on the screen. Thank you, George. Abortion feels hyperpolarized, but what if it's not? The leaked Supreme Court draft opinion on Roe v. Wade has reminded Americans that divisions over abortion are deep, that the issue is far from resolved, and that the conflict remains red hot. That last part, though, was never a given and may not even be accurate. Data show that Americans hold nuanced views about abortion, that they see gray areas, and that their attitudes are contingent upon a variety of circumstances, such as how far along a pregnancy is or how risky it is for the mother. According to a recent Pew Research Center survey, relatively few Americans hold absolutist views on abortion. Only 1 in 5 say it should be legal in all cases, and fewer than 1 in 10 say it should be illegal without exception. So why does our abortion debate feel completely inflamed? Because it has been exploited. In her 2021 book, High Conflict, Why We Get Trapped and How We Can Get Out, journalist Amanda Ripley explains what can turn disagreement, inevitable in any group or community, into potentially ruinous high conflict, a moment when, quote, conflict clarifies into good versus evil kind of feud, the kind with an us and a them. In high conflict, the nuanced middle flees the debate, leaving only the most extreme voices to shout from their two distant poles. The threats feel existential, and the normal rules of engagement, the ones that allow a society to function, cease to apply. The runaway blaze of high conflict is stoked by what Ripley calls conflict entrepreneurs, those who have something to gain from the conflict's continuing and who thus help it along rather than seek to tone it down, bundling conflicts together to make them feel worse and more distressing. These people delight in the fight and in adding fuel to the fire. When it comes to abortion, there are many such entrepreneurs, whether it's GOP candidates trying to rally the base by painting their across-the-aisle counterparts as unrepentant baby killers, or Democrats building their brand by painting a post-Roe world in the galvanizing colors of fear. Whole lobbies live off abortion as a salient conflict, especially on the right. That's partly why the Supreme Court leak felt like such a dog catches car moment. If you've campaigned, fundraised, or organized for decades on the cause of overthrowing Roe, what do you do once it has happened? In certain instances, the entrepreneurs are barely interested in abortion at all. Some individuals and organizations are served by any conflict that pits two sides against each other, that makes partisanship and polarization more entrenched, and that drives up emotions of loathing and anger. Our former president was one. For most of his public life, Donald Trump identified as pro-choice. By the 2016 election season, he was telling lurid tales about how his former allies would, quote, rip the baby out of the womb in the 9th month on the final day, end quote. This domination of the scene by inflammatory actors is tragic, because conflict, when managed well, can be productive. As Ripley writes, quote, "Most conflict, after all, is a force for good. It allows us to defend ourselves, to speak our mind, and pushes them to be better, and vice versa," end quote. When not calcified into a state of high alarm, conflict can be positive. It can force us to reckon with our own beliefs and those of our neighbors. Conflict can motivate us to be better people and compel us to seek solutions that might actually create radical and productive societal change. At the heart of the abortion question is the basic problem of unexpected pregnancies. Both sides could come together and lessen their number if they were to direct their energies toward that task instead of ratcheting up the rhetoric. Expanding access to contraception is an easy compromise that could lessen the need for abortion. Free, high-quality pre- and postnatal care combined with expansive economic and social support for parents and children would make choosing parenthood a less daunting prospect. It would be naive not to acknowledge that there is an incommensurable issue at the base of all of this. There are some who wholeheartedly believe that abortion at any stage is the murder of a human. There are others who believe with the same intensity that abortion access at any point in a pregnancy is necessary for women's equality and autonomy. But we live with incommensurables all the time. We have to. The constructive approach is one of curiosity and recognition, a commitment to finding the common ground that must and always does exist and not to throwing more fuel on the fire. Thus endeth the reading. For our musical interlude, I first thought of a hymn, an Arteal-colored hymnal titled Building Bridges. It's a song that was created to be sung in rounds. Building bridges between our divisions. I reach out to you, will you reach out to me? With all of our voices and all of our visions, friends, we could make such sweet harmony. And these words indeed express the approach I would advocate this morning. However, given that we are here in this sanctuary still in masks and others are tuning in via Zoom, I question whether our singing would produce such sweet harmony. Maybe it would, but instead, Sally has a list of possible videos and songs, and I found Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Waters, sung by John Legend, to just be wonderful, moving. And now the words don't quite match the message of building bridges, but the song does have the word bridge in it. All right, so there we go. Did we have that, George? Well, of all the social and legal debates in our polarized society, few, if any, seem as intractable as the abortion debate. One might think that in the nearly half century since Roe v. Wade, since that court decision in 1973, the issue would be settled, but no, the debate goes on, and perhaps currently as it is at its most intense point since 1973, and because of the anticipated overturning of that Roe v. Wade decision. So on the question of abortion, the religious and culture wars meet head on. And part of the problem, I think, is that the law cannot really satisfy both sides. Typically, our laws try to do two things. One, to secure the liberties of all persons by granting them individual rights, and then two, establish laws to guide in situations where conflicts between these individual liberties arise. But just here, the law runs into a problem, and that's because the question is, what is a person? Thus, the law has to try to make a law about when a person is a person. Now, to many who approve of the present federal laws regarding abortion, they simply can't see what all the fuss is about. It's simple. Allow each person or allow each woman the liberty. to make his or to make her own decision in this matter. It's her body, and it should be up to her to govern it in her own way. So let the government keep out and allow her to have her religious liberty. It's the American way. But it's not that simple, because just here, as I say, the question is, what is a person? And if it's your religious and philosophical position, however you arrived at that position, that decision, that a human fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus is already a person, then logically abortion becomes murder. And if abortion is murder, that makes it a bit difficult to simply chalk this up to a matter of freedom of individual conscience and religious liberty. Who, after all, can lightly stand by when they see a murder being committed? So let me put the argument in the form of a mini debate between the two sides of the issue. And in this debate, I'm going to deliberately set the two sides far apart to sharpen the issue. The con side in this mini debate will represent the position that abortions are never permissible, except, let's say, in the case of grave physical threat to the life of the mother. In other words, from the very moment of conception, as crazy as this will seem to many, the gestational form is to be considered a human being and given all the rights of a human being. The pro side will represent the position that any woman, for whatever reasons, up until when? I'm going to set the issue out clearly. Up until the time of birth, as horrible as that will seem to many, can have a legal abortion. This position assumes that the mother and the mother alone is the one with legal rights, and it's up to her conscience and convictions to decide when the entity she's caring and supporting is to be given human status and human rights. We open the debate with the con side, that's the side against permitting abortions, and it's a side that supports a human life amendment to the Constitution that would recognize a life as human with human rights from the moment of conception. And incidentally, there have been hundreds of such human life amendments proposals in Congress since 1973. I think only a couple of them have made it out of committee. Here we go with the mini debate. Con. I'm supporting a constitutional amendment that would protect a human from the moment of conception. Pro. What? That's got to be the craziest idea I've ever heard of. In the first place, there's no such thing as a human from the moment of conception. Con. Well, if it's not human, what is it? Pro. It's a potential human. It's a fertilized egg that carries the blueprint that will shape itself into an actual human at some future time. Con. Oh, a potential human, huh? Well, tell me, please, when does this potential human become an actual human? Is it in the third month when it begins to look like a human? Or the fifth month at quickening? Or the seventh month with the appearance of brain waves? Or 9 months with birth? Or hey, why not later than this? Perhaps at 1 year when it begins to walk, or 5 years when it goes to school? Pro, cute. Look. The formation of a human is always a process. It's always potential, and it's always actual. Con, yes, that's what I was going to say. It's potential and to some degree actual right from the moment of conception. So how can you draw a line one day and say, from this day forward, I regard this as a human being with human rights? Pro. I admit that my drawing of a line will always seem arbitrary to you, and the drawing of such a line is always at least somewhat arbitrary, but it's also necessary. An acorn, after all, is not an oak tree, And the destruction of acorns is not deforestation. Nor is a human fetus the same as a human being. And the destruction of human fertilized eggs, human embryos, or human fetuses is not the same as murdering human persons. Con. Okay, I admit I have some problems here. But still, I'm not willing to give up wanting some legal protection from the moment of conception. There's a human dimension here. And since it is a partially actualized human, it deserves at least some legal rights. At what point, for example, would you offer legal protection? Pro. My position is that it's the mother's right to decide according to her own conscience, according to her own philosophical and religious sensibilities and convictions. Con. Well, what if the mother's sensibilities lead her to want an abortion for no special reason at 7 or 8 months? Pro. Now, I confess that gives me a problem, but I guess I'd have to allow her to go with her own decision. Con. What? And you were calling me crazy for wanting a constitutional amendment? Now I want it even more. And tell me, what if the mother decided after the baby was born that it still wasn't to be regarded as human with human rights? Do you allow infanticide as well? Some societies have, you know. Pro, no. Of course I don't allow infanticide. After birth, the baby receives the same legal rights as all humans. Con, on what grounds? All it did was pass through the birth canal. What's so magical about that? Pro. Well, as I said earlier, you have to draw the line somewhere. I guess we're just drawing it at very different points on the spectrum, wouldn't you say? Con. That's right. Neither of us is for unlimited free choice. In one sense, we're both in the same boat. At the point where we're to judge the entity to be human, we're willing to try to force our opinions on others. But how else can it be? If you truly believe that a human being is being extinguished, how can you stand back and not try to do something? You have to at least make some kind of protest. Pro. Yeah, I see what you mean. Still, though, you've got to allow more latitude than your constitutional amendment would permit. This little debate, it seems to me, presents the heart of the abortion conflict. And actually, these debaters turned out to be more civil, rational, and open-minded than many. So, how do you go about deciding when we should regard life as human in the sense of deserving and receiving human legal rights? There are perhaps four basic kinds of criteria that can be used. They are, one, a biological criterion, a relational criterion, a multitude of factors, and fourthly, the conferral of rights by society. So let me briefly describe each of these different criteria, and I'm going to spend most of my time on the biological one, since this is the one that gets most play, and plays most prominently in the debate. If one uses the biological criterion for deciding when to consider life within the womb as human, one simply means that when the life in the womb of the mother reaches a certain physical or biological point, it is judged to be human and deserving of receiving full human rights. In the past, various points of demarcation have been used or suggested, and I'm going to move from the most actualized biological potential to the least actualized biological potential. So one, viability, that's the capacity of the fetus to survive without heroic efforts on its own to maintain it. Two, brainwave activity, that's around the 7th month, I understand. Three, quickening, the point at which the mother feels the fetus as alive within it. within her. Fourth, appearance, the point at which the fetus begins to look human. Five, implantation of the fertilized egg into the uterine wall. And six, conception. In recent years, those who use only the biological criterion for determining humanness have increasingly viewed conception as the point for determining humanness. Largely because of improved technology, we are able to see more clearly than ever before that there is an unbroken continuum from conception all the way through birth and then all the way to old age and death, a continuum all the way. And thus, from a strictly biological point of view, conception seems to be the most logical place to mark the beginning of a human life, for here is a new and unique cell that is the foundation of that human life. Any other point of demarcation along the way seems more arbitrary. The human life amendments to the U.S. Constitution, which were represented in that con side of that mini debate, reflect a biological criterion for determining humanness in an absolute way. No consideration is given to any other criteria. The questions that the human life amendments raise, both practical and theoretical, are incredible because it is so foreign to our everyday experience to think of a single cell fertilized egg as a person. Are we to begin holding funerals and memorial services for fetuses that are spontaneously or deliberately aborted at a week, a month, 2 months because they are persons? Are IUDs, which prevent the fertilized egg from attaching to the uterine wall, to be outlawed? And are those women who persist in using them to be put to trial for murder? The practical questions raised by following out the logic of such an amendment are manifold and mind-boggling. Let me address a couple other aspects of this position. This amendment uses only a biological criterion for determining human life, and even within this, it gives no weight to developing biological life. It places all the weight, or almost all, entirely all the weight on potential life. Now, granted that human life is a continuum from the moment of conception, and granted that there is no clear point of demarcation and drawing a line will always seem arbitrary to some degree, the differences between potential and actual or developed human life must, in my opinion, still be considered. A second point of argument with respect to the biological criterion alone as the sole determinant of human life is simply to question this in view of what can be seen in the biological realm itself. Those who wish to protect, nourish, and develop every human fertilized egg seem to view nature or God as the great economizer. This was a term years ago that ethicist Garrett Hardin put forward. But nature or God, as he argued, is obviously not a great economizer of lives. Nature is exceedingly abundant and prolific and extravagant and wasteful. Take your pick of the terms. Studies, for example, indicate that between 50 to 70% of all fertilized human eggs are spontaneously aborted. Many or most of those spontaneous abortions take place early on in pregnancy, often without the knowledge of the mother. Investigation shows that these spontaneous abortions often occur largely because of chromosomal abnormalities in the gestational life. So in one sense, I suppose you could say that nature is economizing here by not permitting a life with such abnormalities to go on. But my larger point is that this high percentage of spontaneous abortions shows that nature is not the great economizer. Along the same line, a human male during his lifetime can be expected to produce something on the order of a million sperm cells, all of which but a possible few will perish without reaching their so-called goal. So too, a human female may start with as many as 100,000 eggs on the way to maturity, with approximately 400 mature eggs perishing, again, without reaching their goal. Now, this is not necessarily an argument for treating the immature human biological life casually. But certainly from a biological point of view, there is no reason to place great value on it. Nature here teaches us no lesson in economy. Additionally, the argument that because each human fertilized egg is unique, it should be saved, this argument too loses its force in the biological perspective. It's true that every fertilized egg is unique, but there are at least 100 million unique combinations possible in every sexual act. So that was the first criteria. I'll go more quickly through the second ones. The second one is the relational one, and it goes like this. This criteria considers a life human when it is able to relate to others and when others are able to relate to it in something like a human way. And here too, as with the biological criterion for determining the beginning of human life, judgments differ in this case on what it means to relate in a human way. For example, according to the standards of self-consciousness and rational thinking, a child would not be able to relate in a human way until well after birth, and some children may never be able to relate in this way. So with the relational criterion, in exact contrast to the biological criterion, very little weight is put on potential development, and a great deal of weight is put on actual development. A second difficulty with the relational criteria is that very little consideration is given to what abortion at a late date or possibly infanticide does to us spiritually, does to us psychologically. It may be argued that it is for our spiritual and psychological sake that a fetus or severely handicapped infant must be treated with respect, not by virtue of either its intrinsic biological value or by reason of its capacity to relate in a human way, but for our spiritual, for our psychological sake. This brings me to a third criterion for determining the beginning of human life. And this criterion would not recognize any definite point of beginning, but would rather see the situation as a gradual accumulation of human rights set over against the competing rights of the mother and perhaps others as well. This third criterion gives increasing weight to the fetus's biological dimension as it develops, and to its capacity to relate as it develops. And it considers also our psychological and spiritual needs, as well as our social, medical, and economic factors. And thus, this criterion would not elevate any single standard or establish any absolute rights, but would find it better to speak of competing rights and values that come into conflict as the fetus develops. Here again, of course, no clear judgment can be made on exactly when a life is human. But here, at least, the complexity of the issue is very apparent. This third criterion doesn't back away from this complexity or try to simplify it. Rather, this criterion values the complexity and sees it as a necessary ingredient in any decision regarding abortion. In regard to this criterion, the issue of abortion ought not to be decided easily, quickly, or casually. It's a tough issue, fraught with moral ambiguity, and any solution that minimizes the complexity and delicacy misses the mark, according to this criterion. A fourth and final approach to the question of when gestational life should be treated as human with human rights may be called the conferral of rights by society. The conferral of rights by society. And this is actually the one that makes the most sense to me. And so this approach, well, taking in all the aspects of the third criterion that I just mentioned, would add one more factor or dimension, namely, the recognition that there is no such thing as intrinsic human life. This criterion consciously recognizes that we are the ones making the call, that we as individuals and a society confer human rights. To this point, we have been considering where to mark the beginning of human life, as well as the different criteria by which to make that judgment. The objective or hope has been to discover the definitive place where it could be said, ah, now here we have a human being, which is somewhat like the old philosophical and theological arguments about when the soul entered the body, that would mark the life as human. So it says, if we imagine that the fetal life form would suddenly manufacture a label reading, attention, human at this point, please grant human rights. I made that sound like an automaton. This fourth approach takes the position that it makes no sense to look for such labels regarding the beginning of human life. We simply won't find them. Whether or not a fetus is a human being deserving of human rights is a matter of definition and not a fact. There's no such thing as humanness waiting to be discovered and recognized. Rather, we confer it, we bestow it, we grant it. The question remains, when shall we as a society confer human rights onto biological life? I don't see a solution to this issue that will satisfy everyone in our society. This issue will likely continue to be an issue over which there will be great disagreement. On the one hand, it's a marvelous thing and a beautiful ideal, as the Right to Life folks promote, to take a human seed, as it were, and from the beginning to value it and care for it, to help it grow and develop so that it can blossom into the fullest possible human being. And in this regard, I remember with the birth of Flossie and my own two children, how we planned and prepared to bring new human life into the world. This was life that we knew about from very early on, and we followed it through every stage of its development. I remember we would regularly go to an exhibit in the museum. There was a display on the stages of development. We watched movies, we read books, we felt the first movement in the womb, and then we became aware of the ongoing growth in the womb, and then we were lovingly present at the birth to welcome this new human life tenderly and lovingly into our world. That's the ideal, and it's a wonderful and beautiful process, and the Right to Life position at its best can point us to that ideal. However, the world is not always ideal, and this is what is not well recognized in the Right to Life movement, as I see it. Not all potential human biological life can be nourished, and there are a multitude of factors that may cause one to weigh whether abortion might be justified in given situations. The common ones, for example, are protection of the physical and mental well-being of the mother, pregnancy that is due to rape or incest, pregnancy due to failure of birth control methods, prevention of the birth of a severely deformed fetus. No one wants abortions. No one, I think, is pro-abortion. But in view of the dilemmas and difficulties that sometimes occur, abortion is sometimes the necessary best decision. Now, in saying this, and in arguing for keeping abortion legal, I recognize that since Roe v. Wade, those who are against allowing the possibilities of abortions have had to stretch themselves the furthest. I recognize that the present federal laws, which allow for some abortions, generally support my worldview, I suspect the worldview of most of you here today, more than they do the worldview of those identified as Right to Life. That, however, may change shortly, and it will be those who are pro-choice who will have to stretch themselves the furthest, we shall see. Whatever the case, I would still argue, as in that opinion piece that I read from Christine Emba, that we need to recognize the complexities of the issue, as so many already do, and that if we are to survive as a society, we have to live what she calls the incommensurables, and that as we live with those incommensurables, we seek as much common ground as we possibly can. It's only a P. For our closing hymn, I've chosen the same hymn that was sung at the last service I was with you at in May, There Is More Love Somewhere, and we're led in the singing by the First Unitarian Brooklyn Choir. The words will appear on the screen, I think, and you're again invited to sing or hum along. As we conclude our service, I'd like to thank our celebrant, Annalise Vance Sherman, our media technician, George Rogers Clark, and as always, our program director, Sally Riggers. And I know that you are ending your time doing this, and I have really appreciated working with you. So our closing words of benediction are from the Reverend Frederick Gillis, and it will be followed by the extinguishing of the chalice by Annalise. May the love that overcomes all differences, that heals all wounds, that puts to flight all fears, that reconciles all who are separated, be in us and among us now and always.